It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, how the shooting of a young black man in Ferguson, Missouri, has triggered a debate about the use of excessive force by local police and racial profiling in America. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Police and protesters have clashed daily since the August 9 killing of Michael Brown, an 18-year-old African-American teenager, by a white police officer in the town of Ferguson. Brown's death has sparked allegations of systemic discrimination against minorities and raised serious questions about the militarization of local police forces in America. Municipal police departments have been the beneficiaries of federal grants since at least 2001, after the terrorist attacks on U.S. soil. They were meant to beef up counterterrorism programs in U.S. cities, a Pentagon program that sends military gear from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan also go to local law enforcement agencies that apply for it. Regarding the racial disparities, a poll conducted by the Pew Research Center shows 80% of African Americans believe Brown's death raises important issues about race compared to 37% of whites. Meantime, daily rallies in Ferguson have turned violent at times in the past 2 weeks. Police have arrested more than 100 protesters, primarily for refusing to leave the streets. At the time of his death, Michael Brown was suspected of shoplifting and roughing up a storekeeper. Authorities, however, say the officer, Darren Wilson, did not know that Brown was a robbery suspect. An autopsy shows Brown was shot 6 times, including twice in the head. A Brown family attorney says the unarmed teen was trying to surrender to police when he was shot. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder traveled to Ferguson Wednesday to meet with community leaders, FBI investigators, and federal civil rights officials to discuss the shooting. Holder says the full resources of the Justice Department are committed to the investigation. He said, however, the town must see an end to violence and that the riots and looting in reaction to the shooting undermine justice. President Barack Obama, America's first black president, also weighed in on the shooting and subsequent protests. Speaking last week, he said there is no excuse for police to use excessive force against peaceful protests or to throw protesters in jail for lawfully exercising their First Amendment rights. But he reiterated there is never an excuse for violence against the police or for those who would use this tragedy as a cover for vandalism or looting. Around the country, rallies have been held to demand justice for Mr. Brown and to protest police tactics. Well, for more on the shooting of an unarmed black teenager in Ferguson and the violent unrest which followed, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Sam Fullwood III is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he analyzes the influence of national politics and domestic policies on communities of color across the United States. Prior to joining the center, Sam was a columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer newspaper, and during the 1990s, he was national correspondent in the Washington Bureau of the Los Angeles Times, where he contributed to the paper's award-winning coverage of the Los Angeles riots in 1992. And Anthony E. Cook, he's professor of law at Georgetown University. He is the author of The Least of These, Race, Law, and Religion in American Culture. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Happy to be here.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Let me begin with you, Sam Fullwood. I'd like to get your reaction. You covered riots in L.A. in the 90s. People have said that in Missouri, in this particular town, there are definite tensions. There's a disproportionate number of white police officers in relation to the community. Talk about your reaction to the shooting and to the riots that ensued afterwards.
I think the first thing that we have to be clear about is that the shooting itself was not the cause of the rioting or even the protest. It may have been the catalytic activity, that is, it was what angered people. But what had been going on in Ferguson, as well as many, many, many other communities all across the country, is demographic change, which has been uneven and has been perceived, particularly by people of color in those communities, as disadvantageous to them. And that has bred long sense of grievance and frustration and anger that is often most exhibited by the interactions between youth and police. And that has been going on for at least maybe 20 years prior to what happened with the shooting. When the shooting happened, it brought forward all of those feelings, and we can now see the aftermath of that in the disturbances in the community.
Anthony Cook, how do you see the aftermath of the shooting? Do you see also these underlying factors having contributed to the protests and to the reaction?
Absolutely. There's a long history of racism and institutionalized discrimination that disproportionately impacts communities like Ferguson, you know, predominantly black communities. That, you know, disproportionality is in, I think, a longstanding history of trying to marginalize communities. You know, Ferguson used to be a predominantly white community, became a predominantly black community. But when it became a predominantly black community, a lot of the rights and liberties and privileges that were afforded the predominantly white community did not accompany the demographic changes. When you look at the voter turnout, sure enough, there are some problems associated with black people not effectively organizing and exercising the franchise in the past few elections. You've had voter turnout that's been 2% to 5%. That is simply unacceptable. But when you look at the practices with regard to disenfranchisement, you see common practices throughout the nation. A lot of the local elections are not held during election year in November. They are held in April, in off months, where voter turnout is going to be very difficult anyway. Voting booths and voting locations are sometimes very difficult to get at. There have been reports that police department, which is predominantly white, 53 police officers, only three of them black, have employed tactics that we all come to understand are tactics geared at low-income minority communities to make sure that they stay away from the voting booths, like putting up barricades and barriers and having the sirens on and the lights on at voting booths. You know, there have been those kinds of things going on as well. And so this helps to institutionalize a history of racism and discrimination in which you're not using race-specific classifications and strategies. No one may be calling you the N-word. No one may be calling you out of your name, right? Or having laws that say no blacks can vote or no blacks can be employed on the school board. But yet the very process by which you have structured the voting system and the means of selecting officers results in disproportionate number of blacks being excluded from the process and marginalized in that process. And that's the problem we're facing here. So what we hope to get out of this, I think, is a national conversation about the ways in which racism and discrimination have morphed and changed, have become more institutionalized, and policy interventions are necessary to deal with the disparate impact that has had on black, Hispanic, and increasingly poor white communities. It's a tragedy that in this day and time, the incarceration rates of America are the highest in the world. We incarcerate more people in America than Russia or China and other countries that we look down on as being violators of human rights, right? When you look at the number of black men that have been incarcerated or are incarcerated in America, we have more blacks who are incarcerated than we had blacks in slavery in 1850. This is not by accident. This is a result of a prolonged and protracted war on terror, war on crime, and by implication, I think, a war on the low-hanging fruit of black, brown, and in some cases, poor white men and women as well.
Turning to you, Sam Fulwood, we want to continue with this conversation and get into other reasons, whether it's the militarization of the police forces and the, one could say, unequal treatment under the justice system toward blacks and other minorities. But pick up on this disproportionate number of white police officers in Ferguson, Missouri. And how is that? I mean, is it that members of the black community are trying to get into the force and are rejected? I mean, how can that be? Because...
Well, I think Anthony touched on one part of it, which I think is very critical. And I mentioned before, the demographic changes. In 1980, 80% of the population in Ferguson, which is a suburb just north of St. Louis, 80% of the population was white. In 2010, the population was 85% black. So you can see the dramatic changing. Traditionally in America, suburbanization has been one where whites moved from the city in a sense of white flight away from minority communities that are settled in and often trapped by unfair and discriminatory housing practices. Whites moved to the suburbs and the suburbs become affluent. We've seen a reversal over the last 20 years across the country, not just in Ferguson and St. Louis, of the suburbs becoming increasingly black and minority populations, communities of color, but they've become poorer. So that what you've seen is the minority populations have moved to suburban communities like Ferguson. The whites then have fled either to the exurbs or in many cases back into the cities, which are being gentrified and pricing out many of the people of color in the inner city communities. So that Ferguson became a predominantly black and it became poorer. Its economic base eroded. And while at the same time that that was happening, over the same 20-year period, the political and the social and the economic infrastructure remained in the hands of whites, such that the school board and the mayor and the police and all the instruments of official life in that community remained white. That is a combustible situation. And we can see that happening all across the country in as suburbs and demographic change takes place. The white community in places like St. Louis or in Ferguson, I don't want to say that they're evil or bad because I don't believe that's the case. What I do think is that there is a sense that they see a way of life changing that's not necessarily in keeping with the way they would like for it to be. The country itself is becoming increasingly minority majority. And that, even if you live in an enclave and you don't have interactions with people who are different than you, it weighs on you in sort of the images and your notion of what America is about. America is changing. And so there's a real intense desire to hold on to and to, in some cases, want to turn back the way in which America is perceived, if no other place than in their mind. And I think that is what contributed to, as you mentioned earlier, the militarization. Over the last 10 years or so, since 9/11, we have become very uncomfortable and uneasy about violence. For the most part, Americans always viewed civil unrest and violent confrontations as something that happens over there. 9/11 sort of made us a little uncertain about it happening here. Yes, we had the riots, the urban unrest in the 60s. We've always had riots in the United States going all the way back. You know, one could argue the country was founded as a riot. But this terrorism thing has really given local law enforcement an opportunity and a reason to strengthen their operations. And what they have done is purchased military armaments, supposedly to be prepared for a terrorist threat. Well, we haven't had anything on the order that would require using armored vehicles and grenade launchers and full body armor. So this was an opportunity to, if you have it, you're going to use it. And it was a gross overreaction because of the capacity that they had to be able to use it. And it totally misread the situation of a community that is in transition, already distrustful, and then you impose this militarism on top of that. That's the reason that we're seeing this being right. So prolonged.
Yes, indeed. Let's talk about that, Anthony, yeah. About the militarization of these police forces in the wake of 9/11, and even one could go back to the 80s, the drug war and so on, but we're just seeing a militarization of these police forces, and instead of police being protectors of the community, they're seen as intimidating. And
yes.
With all of this gear, is it really necessary, and how can we walk this back?
Well, this goes back a long way, of course, right? And we don't have enough time to chronicle the whole history by which there has been this, you know, fraternal relationship that has developed between the federal government and local governments with regard to militarizing the police. But we know of the histories of COINTELPRO, in which black organizations were routinely surveilled and investigated, the surveillance of Martin Luther King Jr. and tapping his phones and his rooms and so forth and so on, the sharing of this data and information and intelligence from the FBI to the local police authorities. When the war on drugs and the war on crime started in the late 1960s. Remember, Nixon comes to office in 68 on a platform of getting tough on crime because of all of the hippies and blacks and women libbers and so forth and so on. In the streets, there had to be law and order returned to this. And what came with that eventually, particularly under the Reagan administration, was a commitment to shore up and to bolster local police authority. And that bolstering of local police authority created a situation where there was an alliance that was created. That was great for politicians who could go all around, get on the stump and say, you know, I'm hard on crime, and then these are the measures I've passed. This is the money that I've given to law enforcement operations across the country in order to accomplish that objective, and so vote for me, right? And of course, there was this trepidation and fear by the general population as these demographic changes began to occur that said, well, I want you to be tough on crime, because remember what the prosecutor or the defense attorneys for the Rodney King case said. You know, these individuals, these police officers, he said, they are the thin blue line that separate the jungle from us, upstanding, privileged white citizens who deserve and should require that our property and our rights and our way of life be protected. You know, that was symbolic, I think, of a very pervasive feeling about who the police officers and who police forces serve and protect and who they don't serve and protect. This is profoundly problematic. The transfer of resources to local police officers under 1033 acts beginning in the 1990s, where you've got military equipment that is suited for Afghanistan and Iraq, right, being transferred to these local police officers. You know, when I saw the police officers come out in the gear that they were equipped with during the first couple of nights, tanks that are built to withstand individual explosive devices and mines, right, in war-torn countries, and the rifles that discharge 60 and 70 rounds per second, I said, you know, where are we? It was clear that they were treating Ferguson like it was an occupied territory, and they were at war against enemy combatants. Whether they said it or not, that was the symbolism, and that is what the people of Ferguson and increasingly around the country are reacting to.
Indeed. Well, not to excuse any looting or violence that emanated from these protests, but one could certainly argue that the tactics of the police probably added fuel to the fire and created even more violence than was necessary.
And, you know, one should point out that there is looting in almost any confrontation of this kind that exists within, you know, tense field, anxiety field environments where you've got people in the streets. It's not new. And we should face that and deal with that and deal with the criminal elements, but we can't use it as an excuse for the suppression of civil liberties and civil rights of those who are peacefully assembling and protesting the injustices that exist in this society.
And indeed, that's what President Obama said. Well, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Sam Fulwood, he's Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, and Anthony E. Cook, from whom you just heard, Professor of Law at Georgetown University. I'm your host, Carol Castiel. We're discussing the many factors that led to the fatal shooting of an unarmed African-American youth in Ferguson, Missouri, and the subsequent violent protests. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. And here's a shout-out to Musa Aboki from Lafia, Nasarawa State in central Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email with feedback to encounter@voanews.com or like and comment on our Facebook page, Carol Castiel VOA. Tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Well, back to you, Sam Fulwood. Let's get into the specifics of the case now that we've laid the groundwork as to why these tensions have boiled over. Reactions to the protests, for example, by the police initially, how they added fuel to the fire. The protests were mostly peaceful, we know, in the initial days. Then we heard about bad apples coming in, perhaps from other jurisdictions, using the tragedy as a pretext to loot, shoot, and so forth, trigger a harsher response from the police. But we also witnessed that Captain Ronald Johnson, an African-American, the head of the Highway Patrol, was brought in. And because he's African-American and much more sympathetic to those who were protesting, that seemed to calm things down. Talk about his role and how the police and other actors are dealing with the protests.
Well, first off, it's really interesting to note the sort of progression of police actions. You had the local police, which really reminded me a lot of the Keystone Cops. That's an American reference of movies of police officers who literally could not do anything right. That was almost from the very beginning. The police seemed, tone deaf is a nice way of putting, their just utter disregard for the sensitivities of the community. And once that became apparent, there was no way that they were going to be able to have any sense of authority to maintain order in that community. Belatedly, the governor brought in the state police, and that was where Captain Johnson, I believe, who was a resident of Ferguson, and he sort of came in as a native son of the community, and there appeared to be some promise that he would be able to at least talk to people in a rational way in the community. Of course, that sort of fell apart as almost concurrent with that, it seemed, that there were these bad actors that sort of infiltrated the protest against the wishes of the people who were protesting Mike Brown's death, engaged in some rather heinous, opportunistic criminal activity, which compelled, you know, more police activity. Ultimately, the National Guard was called in. So there's been this escalation. One of the things that I thought really was remarkable as I've seen this escalating police activity was the response in the community. And for me, the response has been both inspiring and problematic. Inspiring in the sense that we see citizens demanding to be heard about their grievances, and they are willing, even in the face of tremendous physical power of the police, to stand down and challenge that. Mm-hmm. The problematic part of it is that much of the organizing of the protesters has been done through social media. And I think that this is a relatively new phenomenon as a model for organizing and protesting and leadership. It's a leadership model that I don't think we've seen that is probably incompatible with the traditional sense of leadership models, such that people are filming the activities and tweeting it and talking about it in real time and developing an audience of communal support nationwide and maybe globally through the use of social media. The reason I say that this is problematic is that it becomes diffuse and that there is no organizing or no leadership that can negotiate away the grievances with the authorities. And they're talking past each other. There's complete lack of communication, a lack of understanding, a lack of willingness to be able to have some sort of common ground about that. Now, there are people in the community who are trying to calm things down, but it doesn't take much. When people see the police activity, tear gas flying, for example, seeing it in real time and hardening their point of view about what has happened. Traditionally, people would see it in the newspapers or on television, but there would be a filtering effect. That filtering effect now makes people distrust what they see in traditional forms of media.
Right. Well, back to you, Anthony Cook, briefly. We also know that the police withheld information in the early days. This frustrated the people in the community, or they shared information. Again, you know, just the kinds of behavior that sow distrust. I just would like to conclude by asking both of you, you know, where do we go from here? For example, one of our listeners said, is there a possibility that the militarization of police forces within the United States will come under some kind of review now? Mm-hmm. Secondly, do you see potential reform in the U.S. criminal justice system where a disproportionate number of blacks are incarcerated or receive perhaps longer sentences for the same crimes as whites? Do you see Congress poised to act in the wake of this tragedy?
Right. Well, all very good questions. I think this is a rare opportunity. We have a possibility here and the potential of creating a multicultural, multiracial, multi-ideological and bipartisan approach to dealing with this problem. I see libertarians that are upset with the militarization of the police force and this show of force, and they're concerned about the kinds of dollars and support that have flowed to this segment of the government that represents and manifests itself in ways of suppressing the liberties and rights of citizens, right? So libertarians are there with that. I see liberals that are upset that, you know, you've got a situation where black, minority, poor communities are being disproportionately impacted by this brutality, and that there are stories and stories of this kind of excessive force being utilized throughout the nation, and this may be an opportunity to raise that to a level of national discourse. So let's bring these individuals and these parties and organizations together in order to try to do something that can be long-term and long-lasting. So John Conyers has called for instance, in the Judiciary Committee, a review of the police practices, not only of Ferguson, but districts around the nation with regard to these claims of excessive force. There have been other people who have suggested that we need an ongoing presence in these communities that can take the energy that has been created out of a Ferguson, harness that energy for long-term reform. You see, that's been the problem with regard to social media and the like. It's episodic. It's kind of up and down. It's like, you know, that's a form of protest to get online to say, oh, I hate this, or to do a kind of flash mob thing, and then you're back to your business as usual. It's a beautiful way of conveying ideas and messages and sentiment, but what we need are old-style forms of organizing communities, not just on a short-term basis, but on a long-term basis, to deal with the inequities with regard to voting, employment, and excessive force in relationship to community policing that's necessary to transform this moment into something that can transform America.
And the last word to you, Sam Fullwood, because we're going to see how the case plays out, obviously, in the days and weeks to come. But in the long run, these larger questions have been raised by people across the political spectrum and across races, whether or not we're going to see reforms in the U.S. criminal justice system. Do you think we can harness the energy and outrage coming from this case?
You know, I hate to end our conversation on a negative tone, but I am not at all optimistic that that's what's going to come out of this. I do think there will be a thorough investigation. I think there will be lots and lots of arguments and discussions about what has happened in this specific case. If history is any clue, once that the specifics of the Michael Brown shooting and of the police use in Ferguson has dissipated, sort of like the tear gas in the air, the underlying root causes probably are too difficult for most Americans at present to get to. I mean, what we really are talking about are structural changes in the way in which Americans live. And I'm just not optimistic that this incident is the one incident that's going to provoke that kind of a needed conversation.
Well, I'm afraid on that dubious note, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Sam Fullwood, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, and Anthony Cook, Professor of Law at Georgetown University. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific analysis.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Brian Marcoulier. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.